I remember as a kid growing up in a small evangelical church in Northern being reminded in that context regularly that we are the remnant. There are not many churches teaching the real gospel out there. I don't ever remember seeing or hearing as a kid about United churches out there in the North. Maybe some Anglicans, some mostly Catholics and Orthodox, the immigrant churches, and a few evangelical churches. We Christians were a minority, looked down upon. Most of our neighbors in the North in the 60s would prefer to go their own way, living outside of Christ. And of course, in the 1960s, Pierre Trudeau was leading us towards godless, secular, humanist, communist vision of society. There was literally a little red tract of the threat of Pierre Trudeau to evangelical Christians. Now, that little paragraph there is a narrative, a way of crafting information or data that constructs a story of how we should think and therefore act in regard to that data. I could say that narrative was a scarcity narrative. We just needed to be able to survive the onslaught. But that's not what I remember in the experience of church life. I remember church life as full and vibrant and warm and welcoming, a place where as a preteen I wanted to be. It was a place of life and action and encouragement to my spiritual journey. The narrative I was being given was of scarcity. The story I inhabited was one of fullness. Now, here's another narrative. The reality is that our current membership trajectory, conversions, falling attendance, the number of churches that are in decline, as well as the churches that are only a few years away from closing, are leading us to a bleak and unsustainable outcome. Now, that's a narrative that many churches in Canada are hearing on a consistent basis. We are in decline. I don't need to cite more sources. That's a narrative that's coming to all of us, from StatsCan, from news media sources, from the sociologists, from the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada, from the now defunct Waybase, and from our denominational offices. But that's not what I'm experiencing in the church where I serve. Our local congregation, St. Catharines, was birthed over 60 years ago. It has seen its share of good days and bad days, years of thriving, years of just surviving. Today we're 70-ish people, and we're full of college and university students, young families with children. The same year as the boomers, are a small percentage. We stayed relatively healthy and connected through the pandemic. And we're now a larger community than we went into the pandemic. Yes, we lost some people, but we also gained people right in the midst of the shutdown. People in our city joined us, not just my mother watching from Selby. And our finances were never really a problem. One older couple who joined us about 10 months ago were wandering in our city looking for a church after their large multi-site church kind of imploded years ago. They are long-time committed active Christians. Over the course of the year, they visit a number of churches in our city looking for. They essentially come to the conclusion there were few churches that they were comfortable with theologically that felt alive. They were preparing to stop looking for a church and just have a weekly Bible discussion with other wandering friends. They've heard that story before. Then an old woman in their neighborhood told them to try to church her 20-something grandson and his family attend. It turns out this couple lived just four blocks from our building. They tell me the reason that they've been with us literally every Sunday since they walked through the doors is that this church feels alive. It's not on palliative care waiting to die. The narrative that we're being given is of scarcity and decline. The story I inhabit is one of fullness. Last year, James Emery White commented on the Canadian report from Alpha Canada, a flourishing congregation. White's the former president of Gordon Conwell Seminary. And White says, the church is in decline because we are turned inward instead of outward. Our hearts are not breaking for what breaks the heart of God, which is people facing a Christless eternity. And sadly, only a simple invite is all that is often needed. Come and see, come and hear, come and explore. So that's the antidote that I hear in much of this narrative of decline, is that we just need to do something. We just need to do something. James White says we just need to invite people. We need to turn outward instead of inward. Others say we just need to pray more, or just modify our Orthodox theology. And then our congregations will be thriving again. People will love us again. We'll be relevant again. And then we'll return to the place of privilege and influence in Canadian society. If that were ever true.
Yeah.
But is that really the goal? So in this brief reflection, I want to connect with the Wesley and the Methodist experience in a time of spiritual decline. I want to connect with alternative perspectives regarding our moment. And in conclusion, I want to reflect on an alternative Wesleyan narrative, because we're always the alternative. So, in a blog post during a recent pandemic, Bishop Richard Jackson, for the Diocese, the Church of England, were called. At the beginning of the 18th century, Thomas Carlyle described Britain's condition as stomach well alive, soul extinct. Deism, the belief that God made the world, set it running, and then went on to something else, was widespread. Sir William Blackstone visited the church of every major clergyman in London and said, I did not hear a single discourse which had more Christianity in it than the writings of Cicero. Bishop Berkeley wrote that morality and religion had collapsed to a degree that was never known in any Christian country. We might say that the Church of England in the early 1700s was a state of spiritual decline. The religious hierarchy was well established as the state church, but what Whitfield and Wesley found in 1739 was that very few of their fellow citizens, or at least the everyday common folk, were attending their local parishes, hence their resorting to field preaching outside the gates of the coal mines around Bristol. And we might say that Wesley had been attempting to do something about those conditions for most of his adult life before May 1738. He was studying, he was praying, he was fasting, he was caring for the poor, he was accessing the means of grace, he was preaching, he was exhorting, to no avail in his personal life or in his congregation. And then God showed up. We might say that Wesley's life is in a state of his recent experience in Georgia, first as a missionary, then as a parish minister, did not turn out well. His contact with the Moravians during that time have also led him to question his experience of the faith that he said he believed. So let's think of this crucible point in Wesley's life as three encounters. encounters with God, with Christian community, and the world. The encounter with a God who shows up on God's timing, when our hearts are ready to respond, has been offered, when we stop striving. The encounter with Christian community, which is instrumental in the preparation of hearts open to God. And the encounter with the inhumanity of humans, the plight of the world, that leads to gracious, hope-filled engagement in concrete terms for the sake of both the body and the soul. Perhaps these foundational, we might say transcendent encounters that Wesley has something to offer us for the times in which we are becoming a secular society. The church is in decline. We are losing our voice in the public space, and we must do something about it. That's the word of caution and concern. So, in his book, A Secular Age, don't worry, we're not going to do a review. In his book, Charles Taylor describes what this shift looks like by naming three ways that secularization is expressed. This more nuanced understanding adds complexity to the competing narratives of religious decline on the one hand, or the narrative of social progress on the other. So Taylor's first explanation indicates that religious worldview retreating from public spaces and spheres, making religion a largely private matter. Put it another way, in a secular society, you can engage fully in politics without ever encountering God. Do you realize how much God talk doesn't happen in Canada compared to the south of the border? Another way, you can, or the removal of the Christmas Nativity. Oh, wow, that was just a recent discussion in St. Patrick's. The second way of expressing secularization builds on the first, but is described as a reduction in religious involvement when compared to other activities in an individual's life or importance. So this is where decline in worship attendance and or discipleship practices is identified as secularization. And the third and formal form of, final form of secularity, Taylor describes as exclusive humanism, a concept that defines the idea of good without God or anything or anyone transcendent. The first two dimensions of secularization are the more obvious concerns of the narrative of decline. But it's the third, more subtle and pervasive dimension, which and is perhaps not as likely to be resolved by doing something. So I'm not going to defend my take on secular age. That's the backdrop. Now let me take you on a little journey of my own reflection. Got a little book here, The End of Christendom by Malcolm Muggeridge. He gave a lecture when I was 18 years old at the University of Waterloo. I read this book 2 years later because I worked in a Christian. British journalist and social analyst, 40 years ago, delivered a lecture. He was describing social circumstances, 40 years ago, that were contributing to the decline of Christendom in Western society. I remember reading at the time a statement in this little book, in these circumstances, why should anyone expect Christendom to go on forever or see in its impending collapse a cosmic catastrophe? For that pessimistic reflection, he offered this optimistic word, amidst the shambles of a fallen Christendom, I feel a renewed confidence in the light of the Christian revelation with which it first began. Muggeridge then suggests where his renewed confidence comes from. the thriving of Christian faith and community in locations where it has been most repressed. Now, in his historical context, talking the 60s and the 70s, he was referring specifically to the underground church in communist world. My own experience in places like India and Sri Lanka, I understand what he's getting at. His conclusions here is, let us then, as Christians, rejoice that we see around us on every hand and behave in the institution. For it's precisely when every earthly hope has been explored and found wanting, when every possibility of help from earthly sources has been sought and is not forthcoming, it's then that Christ's hand reaches out, sure and firm. Wes Muggeridge was describing the impact of modernity upon the inherited forms of Christian faith, suggesting that that decline might not be a bad thing. That was part of my early formation as a young Christian 4 years ago. I've never been too worried of the Christian. Just a couple of years after Muggeridge, Brueggemann said, I believe we're in a season of transition when we're watching the collapse of the world as we know it. Speaking to pastors 20 years ago, Roxborough said, a bomb, of course, has gone off in our hearts. And we've become aware that something is amiss, but practically speaking, we don't know what to do about it. A decade earlier, he had connected the language of liminality in this experience, liminality being that intermediate or in-between state between one way of constructing reality and on the threshold of a new, as yet undefined state. Roxborough helped us to understand that something new is in the process of being birthed, something over which we have limited control. More recently, he summed up the challenge in this manner. Our primary map has been modernity. And modernity in many ways has profoundly reshaped and even deformed the Christian imagination in our culture. And he suggests that one of those inner maps tells us that we have to find a way into in order to make things work. In the midst of this time of deconstruction, Roxborough notes, the Spirit has continually disrupted the church throughout its history, taking it to places where once accurate maps no longer apply. This is not a time for fear or dire predictions of the church's demise. So these reflections speak to the narrative of decline, as expressed in Taylor's Secular 1 and 2. Our present situation is not a surprise. Anyone paying attention over the last 50 or 60 years, some of us have been there that whole time, some of us haven't. If you've been paying attention to the last 50 or 60 years, there's nothing surprising about the moment we're in. Yes, it's happening, but it's not the end of the world. Perhaps it's even the birth of something new. What we need to pay attention to, however, is Taylor's secular theory. All belief is contested and thus made fragile. We'll have Andrew Root. What's it? We live in a secular age because we can imagine living, and at times we do live, as though there is no transcendent quality to life at all. He suggested most of us live as though there is no living God who enters into persons. We hold to the idea of God, but few of us are sure we can encounter this God. And so it's in this context that Root declares the church cannot produce this. So here's my big bold statement. The response to our present moment is not we need to do something. So this is the point where I'd like to return to Wesley and his three encounters with God who shows up, with Christian community, and with a stranger. In our current conversation, we might ask, what would John Wesley bring to the table here? And this is just Dan's questions. Is there really something we should be doing? Encounter with the other, the God who shows up. On the ship bound to Georgia in 1735, Wesley experienced fierce storms and waves, with the fear of the ship being sunk. He was terrified, revealing to him the weakness of his faith, producing personal shame. The German Moravian believers on that ship, on the other hand, seemed ready to meet their deaths with calm assurance, continuing with worship and prayer in the midst of the storm. Wesley writes, he had never encountered such personally assured faith, and he noted in his journal on seeing their behavior, "This was the most glorious day which I have ever hitherto seen." They all survived the storm that day. 3 years later, Wesley's experience at the Aldersgate Society was in a similar in a personal crisis, doubting his own abilities and spirituality, depressed, Wesley joins in a simple Bible study format where believers are reading scripture and praying for enlightenment. I'm going with the non-scholastic Luther Romans. He gathered in a simple Bible study format, seemingly with no other effort on his part. Wesley has an encounter with someone who is other than himself. And he cannot express it in any other way than that God warmed his heart strangely. So, a Wesleyan narrative might suggest that we wait upon God in worship with prayerful expectation, not presumption. Spiritual disciplines, the means of grace, waiting on God to show up, when God will show up in God's time, allowing the space for the dialectic of response to God's freely offered freedom and grace. I wonder if that's how Wesley might have expressed it. And the encounter with the other, the community of God's people. Wesley's encounters with God were often realized within the context of a gathering of believers. As a frightened onlooker aboard that ship to Georgia, Wesley observed something transcendent in the gathered worship of those Moravians. A few years later, despite his own attempts to assuage his soul, it was in the small gathered community of believers at Aldersgate that he had his breakthrough moment with God. And then shortly following this experience, Wesley traveled to Germany to explore it in Paramount Hall.
On the way.
On the way. To explore the Moravian model of ministry, he realized that to them, the corporate aspect of conscious religious renewal through living faith signified, as it were, the recapturing of the life of the faith of the primitive Christian. Commenting on the class meeting as a prudential means of grace, Wesley argued, there is something not easily explained in the fellowship of the Spirit, which we enjoy in a society of living Christians. Wesley wisely discerned the beginnings of faith in a person's heart could be incubated into saving faith more effectively in the warm Christian atmosphere of the society than in the chill of the world. I'm stepping back into this paragraph, I should say, but commenting on Karl Barth's ecclesiology, Howard Snyder suggests, and I know it's because we've had a conversation, suggests that the significance of the church is that as a provisional representation, it is the place of the demonstration of Christ's reconciling work. Community is the central fact of the church's being. It's coming together. It's gathering together in Christ's name. So a Wesleyan narrative suggests that the intentional gathering together of believers in these smaller groupings is a prime setting for encounter with God mediated through the fellowship of the Spirit. All the one another's in the New Testament require an intentional fellowship. So allowing space for the dialectic of response one to another in the fellowship under the framework of Christian love. wonder if that's how Wesley might have expressed this. And then encountering the stranger as other, acts of mercy as transformative. Wesley's encounters with the poor and other marginalized people were life transforming. He connects engagement with the poor and the marginalized, whoever is being othered, as a means of grace, as a practice necessary to sanctification. The transcendent Spirit of God is present and transforming the servant in the act of service. Jamie Robertson has suggested that this is one of his new little book there, that a distinctive of Canadian Christianity is the way in which successive waves of immigrants have brought their expressions of the faith to renew the faith of those who are previously. This is something that's happening in an unprecedented manner presently, as Stuart commented on this. And I would say it's perhaps being overlooked as a source of renewal in the Canadian church in our present moment. Is the dynamic faith of newcomers to Canada being welcomed? And are we adjusting our practices in God moment? So a Wesleyan narrative requires working out our salvation through encounter with God. Surrounding how we treat our neighbor, both the unbelieving stranger and our fellow believer of another country. In a recent article in Faith Today, Chris Bosch and Long Wong commented, there are megatrends, like the decline of Christianity, the local church can't do anything about. Since death is a part of human life, it's part of the life of churches. They go on to say, a healthy church can benefit from asking questions why it exists. Not how to do something, but why do we exist? Why does this called out community of Christians? That's a question I reflect on fairly frequently. Not out of a sense of despair, but to continually adjust my focus when things are getting blurred by this narrative of concern or that strategic plan. Charles Taylor, that's where he connects again the importance of social imaginary, or as he said, the articulation of a story, a narrative that shapes who we are and where we want to go, what we're trying to bring out. If I was continually reflecting on the narrative of decline that it seems many are, that would probably lead to despair. If I was to continually reflect on the narrative of we've got to do something, that would probably lead to burnout. Matthew 11, Jesus laments or denounces the towns that were unresponsive to his ministry, including Capernaum, where he had invested significant time. And then he carries right on, and I praise you, Father, because you've hidden these words and the wise and revealed them to these guys that are with him. And then he concludes that little pericope there, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. I hear a narrative in this passage. All my energy invested there, Jesus said, seems to have had limited results. The Father reveals to whom the Father reveals, and this is who he gave. Come to me and I'll give you rest. That's an alternative narrative to you're not being effective, so you need to speed up and do something. So here's my Wesleyan narrative, my alternative narrative. Not a formula, but a story I tell myself that centers my call. We're living in challenging times. And most people are fine with that. That God seems to be absent in these challenging times. We live in a society that doesn't really care about the conversation. Our task is to equip to prepare the congregation for their daily ministry interface with this set of circumstances in which we find ourselves. I've got five people in my church who are on strike. They're kind of running. These are people all with master's degrees in life. They're immigrants. They've been living here in Canada for a dozen years. They did a master's degree or a PhD at Brock University. So for 5 years, I wrestled with, how do we do something missional here? And this narrative right here has been wrapped up around, actually, I just need to help them be able to interface with the church in every sphere in which they live their life. And so my ministry is to encourage, to we need to experience the living resurrected Christ as present in our lives. We need to experience the encouraging spirit-directed promptings of our brothers and sisters as life-giving, as necessary. And we need to experience opportunities for engaging and serving those who are different from us. In short, we exist to affirm that the living God is not absent from our society, and that the truth of that impacts how we live. And as we do this, we bear faithful witness. So my literal conclusion is here. Our task is to simply facilitate the observance of and participation. And in doing so, we have the most consistent record of God showing up in powerful ways to convert, to sanctify, to renew, to transform. That's the narrative that gets me out of the morning. Will the work survive? Well, I think that's a question for the God of the ages.